The Sunstone Foundation presents Mother Earth and Father Sky, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about.
Almost right. Actually, I have two MAs, and you mix the two of them together, you combine the two. Rather coincidental things today. Last year, Clyde Forsberg gave a paper, and I was his respondent, and so this year, he gets even with me. He's relishing this moment, but that's okay. I have news for him, too. With all due apologies, my paper's a little bit bigger than I originally intended. Just kidding.
Yes, so I deserve that.
That's why I said that. Somehow last year the final version of his paper got to me about a week before the symposium, and it was three times the size of the one I had written my response to. So I stood up and I gave my original response, cutting out whatever I could that was no longer applicable and trying to throw in a few other comments. So there was a mix-up, but not entirely his fault, I'll have to admit. Actually, my paper is smaller, and we'll probably have lots of time for questions afterwards, unless Clyde's got a lot more than I have written down. The official title of my paper would not fit on the program, I guess, so they put Mother Earth and Father Sky, and nobody knew what the heck that meant, and that's why you're all here, and you're going to walk out as soon as you find out it's not what you thought. The official title is Mother Earth and Father Sky in LDS Scriptures and Ancient Near Eastern Belief. Let me start by quoting from Moses chapter 7, first of all, verses 48 and 49. And it came to pass that Enoch looked upon the earth, and he heard a voice from the bowels thereof, saying, Woe, woe is me, the mother of men. I am pained, I am weary because of the wickedness of my children. When shall I rest and be cleansed from the filthiness which has gone forth out of me? When will my Creator sanctify me, that I may rest and righteousness for a season abide upon my face? And when Enoch heard the earth mourn, he wept and cried unto the Lord, saying, O Lord, wilt thou not have compassion upon the earth? This attribution of human qualities to the earth is found in Joseph Smith's addition to the book of Genesis, known to us as the seventh chapter of Moses. In the same chapter, we find God described with the attributes of nature, his tears being rain falling to the earth. I read verses 28 and 29. And it came to pass that the God of heaven looked upon the residue of the people, and he wept. And Enoch bore record of it, saying, How is it that the heavens weep and shed forth their tears as the rain upon the mountains? And Enoch said unto the Lord, How is it that thou canst weep, seeing thou art holy, and from all eternity to all eternity? Most ancient people saw the earth as a mother goddess, and the sky as her husband. For example, the Canaanite sky god Baal was thought to ride across the heavens on the clouds, casting down lightning spears and producing rain and wind. His voice was the thunder. Baal's wife was Anat, whose name means surface of the earth. Though sometimes termed a virgin, one of her epithets is mother of men, as in the Enoch passage which we have cited. Anat was also the goddess of war. Each year, during the dry season, she would slaughter men on the earth. After wading through the blood and gore, she would go to the sea and cast her filth into the water. She would then call upon Baal to send down rains to cleanse her body. As we found in the Moses passage, the rains come down and purify the earth. These rains were also Baal's way of impregnating his wife, who conceived and bore vegetation in its season. The seasons and weather in general were, in fact, explained as the interaction between the various gods. Baal controlled the waters in the sky, but Yam, whose name means sea, was sovereign over all earthbound bodies of water. The struggle between the two deities led to a deadly duel in which Yam slew Baal. In his turn, Yam was slain by Anat, who thereby proved her right to be the goddess of war. Storms at sea undoubtedly gave rise to the stories of the battle between Baal and Yam. While Yam threw waves up at his adversary, Baal blew wind and cast down his lightning spears. When the battle was over, Yam was clearly the winner, for the waters were again calm, while the clouds, wind, rain, and thunder had disappeared. By the same token, the crashing of waves on the shore represented the battle between Yam and Anat. The earth goddess prevailed, however, for the sea always receded while the land was unmoved. And did not recede as much on the Mediterranean, by the way, despite the movie Ben-Hur, when he goes on the ship and he says, "I must leave," he says to his sweetheart, "before the tide goes out." But there's no tide on the Mediterranean. Well, whatever. The loss of the sea god spelled disaster for the earth. Without rains, there would be no vegetation. Without plant food, the animals and mankind would perish. Anat presented these facts to Mut, whose name means death, the god of the underworld, in whose realm Baal now resided. Mut realized that all life would cease on the earth and that his realm, too, would eventually stop growing. So the two struck a bargain. 6 months of the year, Baal could remain in the sky, consorting with his wife. The other 6 months, he would be confined to the underworld for the Canaanites and others. This myth explained the seasonality of rainfall. In the Ugaritic documents, we have a number of items referring to Baal, which later showed up in the Hebrew Bible in reference to Jehovah. I'll use the term Jehovah, if you don't mind, since it's more familiar to most of you, though some will disagree with that pronunciation, of course. For example, Jehovah is described as, quote, "He who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind," in Psalm 104, verse 3. "Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud," Isaiah 19:1. "There is none like unto the God of Yeshurun, who rideth upon the heavens in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky," Deuteronomy 33:26. "Extol him that rideth upon the heavens." ... "The earth shook, the heavens also dropped at the presence of God. Thou, O God, didst send a plentiful rain," from Psalm 68, verses 4, 8, and 9, which, by the way, are that psalm is mostly out of the Ugaritic literature. It's kind of like Latter-day Saints singing "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," which is a Lutheran hymn, except that the contrast between the religions isn't as stark. In the contest atop Mount Carmel, it was Jehovah, not Baal, who was able to send down lightning from heaven. Indeed, that contest was a deliberate attempt on the part of Elijah to prove that Jehovah was more powerful than all the gods of Canaan. Hence, it took place atop the mountain whose name means Vineyard of El, referring to the Canaanite chief deity, and the sacrifice was a bullock, sacred to El, whose full title is Father Bull El in the Ugaritic literature. The wood used was undoubtedly from the oak trees which still cover the top of the mount and which were considered sacred to Asherah, El's wife, the fertility goddess whose name means grove, meaning a grove of trees. The prophets of Baal waited in vain to hear the voice of Baal, or thunder from heaven. By sending down lightning, Jehovah proved that he was more powerful than Baal. When the resulting fire destroyed the bullock, symbol of El, the wood, symbol of Asherah, the water, symbol of Yam, and the stones and the dust, symbols of Anat, he proved that he was more powerful than all of the Canaanite deities. Significantly, Elijah's contest appears to have taken place around the time of the first rains, when, according to Canaanite belief, Baal resurrected for the wintertime and returned to the sky, whence he could send down rains to cleanse his wife, after her bloody battles, the earth goddess Anat. Mount Carmel, beside which the Kishon River runs, is the ideal representation of Anat. For it is a prominent piece of the goddess's body, the region that receives the greatest amount of rain and lightning, ostensibly from Baal, of course, and the spot where the earth, Anat, represented by the mountain, juts out into the sea, Yam, symbolic of the battle between Anat and Yam. Elijah's prayer for rain while the false prophets were being slain might imply that it was, in fact, the Feast of Tabernacles, just prior to the onset of the annual rains. Casting the corpses of the slain prophets of Baal into the river Kishon, whence they would have washed into the nearby Mediterranean Sea, reminds us of Anat casting her filth into the sea. The Jewish practice of casting out one's pocket lint during the month of Tishrei prior to the Day of Atonement and the prayers for rain at the Feast of Tabernacles seems to reflect this ancient story. Jehovah, like Baal, is said to be married to the land in a number of passages. I've got references in this if you ever see the printed version. It is he who sends rain down upon the earth and which becomes fruitful as a result. In Hosea chapter 2, the Lord threatened my wife, Israel, that he would, quote, "make her as a wilderness and set her like a dry land," unquote, because she had taken a new lover, the Canaanite Baal. Carrying the imagery further, he said, in chapter 2 still, "Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband," that is to say Jehovah, "for then it was better with me than now. For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof and my wine in the season thereof. And I will visit upon her the days of Baalim," which is the plural of Baal. "And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi," which literally means my man. I'll come back to that, I guess. "And thou shalt call me no more Baali," which is my husband, "for I will take away the name of Baalim out of her mouth. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness. And thou shalt know the Lord, and it shall come to pass in that day I will hear, saith the Lord. I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth. And the earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil." Again, you can see that the earth is hearing as it spoke in the other passage we read. The Hebrew Canaanite term Baal means my husband, while Ishi in the passage we've just cited means my man, also my husband, of course, by extension. The Lord, while claiming his status as Israel's husband, was asking the people to avoid use of the normal term, which made them think of the pagan sky god. It is clear from this and other stories, including Elijah's contest atop Mount Carmel, that many Israelites identified Jehovah with Baal. The earth was, at least symbolically, the wife of Jehovah, as reflected in the words, "The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein," in Psalm 24. This opening verse of Psalm 24 reminds us that this particular psalm contains a number of elements found in the Ugaritic Baal epic. For example, verse 7 reads, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." This appears to be a borrowing from the Ugaritic poetic lines spoken by Baal to the other gods as they bowed their heads in fears of Yam's challenge to combat. And I quote, "Lift up your heads, O ye gods, and be ye lifted up, ye everlasting ones." The hill of the Lord in verse 3 reminds us that Baal lived atop a hill called Tzafon, meaning north, which is depicted in Isaiah 14 and also in Ezekiel 28 as the residence of Jehovah. Only those with clean hands and a pure heart are allowed to enter Jehovah's sanctuary in the Psalm 24. That is, they had to cleanse themselves of filth, as Anat cleansed herself prior to entering into the palace of her father El after slaying Yam. Several scholars have compared her victory march with the passage in Psalm 24, 7-10, declaring Jehovah's victory in battle. It was while marching through the fields that Anat was cleansed by water sent from her consort Baal. In the Bible, Jehovah sends floodwaters to sweep the wicked off the earth, which they have corrupted. In the Ugaritic text, Baal is depicted as the loser in his battle against the sea god Yam, while it is Anat who defeats Yam. But the Bible makes Jehovah victorious over the sea and gives him some of Anat's attributes. For example, note the following extracts from Psalm 68. "Extol him that rideth upon the heavens. The earth shook. The heavens also dropped at the presence of God. Thou, O God, didst send a plentiful rain. But God shall wound the head of his enemies and the hairy scalp of such an one as goeth on still in his trespasses, that thy foot may be dipped in the blood of thine enemies," which, by the way, is right out of the Ugaritic literature regarding Anat's battle against people on the earth in the summertime. "To him that rideth upon the heaven of heavens, which were of old, lo, he doth send out his voice," which is thunder, of course, "and that a mighty voice." Jehovah's victory over the sea monster is described in several passages and is sometimes used to denote the dividing of the Reed Sea, rather than Red Sea, by the way, which is a mistranslation, at the time of the Exodus, when it was a phenomenon of weather, the wind, which saved the Israelites. And I quote from Psalm 74, which reflects Exodus 14. "Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters. Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces, and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness. Thou didst cleave the fountain and the flood. Thou driest up mighty rivers." Let me read from a couple of other passages here relating this. Job 26, for example, "He bindeth up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not rent under them. He holdeth back the face," and I wonder if here we're referring to Anat, but maybe not, "of his throne, and spreadeth his cloud upon it. He hath compassed the waters," which is Yam, "with bounds." The bounds of the waters in the Bible are the earth, the landmass. until the day and night come to an end. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his reproof. He divideth the sea, again Yom, with his power. And by the way, the word Yom means sea, if I may remind you of that. And by his understanding he smiteth through the proud. By his spirit, and the Hebrew in this case uses the word ruach, which means wind, or by his wind then, if you will. He hath garnished the heavens. His hand hath formed the crooked serpent. Lo, these are parts of his ways, and how little a portion is heard of them, but the thunder of power, who can understand? In Isaiah 19, we also have the Lord riding upon the cloud. Let me read one other here. Let's see where this is from. I may not have time to read all these. Psalm 18. Then the earth shook and trembled. The foundations also of the hills moved and were shaken. He bowed the heavens also and came down. Darkness was under his feet. And he rode upon a cherub and did fly. Yea, he did fly upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his secret place. His pavilion was found about him were dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. At the brightness that was before him, his thick clouds passed. And hailstones and coals of fire, maybe meteorites, who knows, out of heaven, in other words. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the highest gave his voice, thunder, hailstones and coals of fire. Yea, he sent out his arrows, the lightning arrows, and scattered them. He shot out lightnings and discomfited them. You see the two are in parallel there in the poetry. Then the channels of water were seen, and the fountains of the world were discovered by at thy rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of thy nostrils. Maybe I should just note the writing on the cherub. Cherubim are the Hebrew kruvim does not denote angels, as we usually think, thanks to all those Renaissance painters who put little babies with wings on them. These are, in fact, winged animals, usually bulls. And typically, the Canaanite and the Hittite gods are seen riding on top of winged bulls. Let's see, there was another one here from Isaiah 50. Behold, in my rebuke I dry up the sea, I make the rivers a wilderness. Their fish stinketh because there is no water, and they die for thirst. I clothe the heavens with blackness, and I make sackcloth their covering. Sounds very much like the same kinds of things said about Baal and Anat in the Ugaritic literature. Peoples of the ancient Near East thought of the earth as the mother of mankind. The idea is reflected in some biblical passages. The earthly tomb, for example, is sometimes compared to the mother's womb, and I've published something on this that some of you may have read. As children of the earth, human beings, like vegetation or crops, are subject to periodic harvests, including that of the last days in the biblical account. In the ancient Near East, warfare was carried on during the summer season when there were no rains to slow down the progress of marching armies. This was when Anat, goddess of war in the earth, wreaked destruction on her children, followed by purification by means of rain. The Bible implies a tie between the earth and wars. For example, a well-known statement by Jesus in Matthew 24:6-7, where earthquakes are mentioned in connection with wars and plagues associated with lack of agricultural produce. And I quote, "And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars, for nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in diverse places." In the Bible, as in the Ugaritic myths, bloodshed seems to result in pollution of the earth. After the earth received Abel's blood, it ceased producing for Cain, who was a farmer. The annual prayers for rain at the Feast of Tabernacles, following the summer period of war, may have some tie to ritual purification of the earth. That is, in order for the earth to produce crops beginning in the spring, it had to be cleansed by ceremony and by rains during the winter. In the Bible, the cleansing of the earth comes both by means of water and by means of fire. That is, the fire from heaven, as we have in 2 Kings chapter 1. Note, for example, Ezekiel 21-24, a prophecy spoken against Jerusalem and the land of Israel. The wicked are to be slain by the sword, and there is blood in the land and bloodshed in Jerusalem. Quote, "In thee have they humbled her that was set apart for pollution," unquote. The Lord will punish Jerusalem and Israel by fire and will consume the filthiness in the land. Then follows the statement, quote, "Thou art the land that is not cleansed nor rained upon in the day of indignation," unquote. Because of the pollutant blood, the wicked of Jerusalem are to be destroyed by sword and by fire in order that evil might be removed from the land. I hear you wheezing back here. It reminded me that the other coincidence is last year when I spoke, I was ill. Or when he spoke and I responded, I was ill. This year I speak, he responds, and he's ill. So, serves him right. We do. Neither one of us is going to volunteer. Good question. In Ezekiel 36, we find that the water which comes down to bring cleansing also brings crops, clearly indicating that rain is the referent. Quote, "Then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and ye shall be clean from all your filthiness, and from all your idols will I cleanse you. I will also save you from all your uncleanness, and will call for the corn, and will increase it, and lay no famine upon you. And I will multiply the fruit of the tree and the increase of the field, that ye shall receive no more reproach of famine among the heathen." This clearly reflects the ideas found in the Torah concerning rain and crops being the result of obedience to the Lord's commandments. Isaiah 2 discusses the same subject. In chapter 1 he wrote, quote, "Your hands are full of blood. Wash you and make you clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes," unquote. "Sins, though scarlet, will be as white as snow, and though red like crimson, will become white," he also says. The tie between blood and sin is clear-cut. He further wrote that if the people obeyed, they would eat the good of the land, which, of course, comes from the abundant rains. If they rebelled, they would be devoured with the sword and burned. In Isaiah 4 and 4, we read of the time, quote, "When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning," unquote. The idea of washing away filthiness is also found in Proverbs 30 and 12. In both this passage and in Isaiah 4 and 4, the Hebrew word for filth is cognate to the Ugaritic word used in the story of Anat, who casts her filth into the sea. The Book of Mormon is less direct in assigning to the Lord qualities which ancient peoples attributed to the sky god. For example, there are a few passages indicating that the Lord sends forth rain upon the face of the earth, that she may bring forth her fruit and her grain in the season of grain, quoting from Helaman 11. The use of her for the earth in this passage and in others is not really evidence of anthropomorphism, since everything in Hebrew is either masculine or feminine, and the word earth happens to be feminine. Nevertheless, some of the language associated with older Canaanite beliefs is retained. For example, the river in Lehi's vision represented filthiness and hell, the abode of the wicked who are cut off from the tree of life by a flaming fire, says he, like lightning. Satan is also depicted as one who leads about the people, quote, "even as chaff is driven before the wind, or as a vessel is tossed about upon the waves, without sail or anchor, or without anything wherewith to steer her," unquote, in Mormon chapter 5. The Lord promised the Jaredites that though they would be swallowed up in the depths of the sea, he would rescue them by, quote, "the winds which have gone forth out of my mouth, and also the rains and the floods have I sent forth," unquote, in Ether 2. In the Ugaritic text, thunder is the voice of Baal. The same thunderous voice is attributed to Jehovah in the Bible, as we've seen. In the Book of Mormon 2, we read of the tremendous power of the Lord's voice, which causes the heavens to open and shut, the earth to quake, and the waters to dry up. For example, Helaman chapter 12 and Ether chapter 4. The angel who appeared to Alma and the sons of Mosiah, quote, "spake as it were with a voice of thunder, which caused the earth to shake," unquote. In later years, Alma lamented that he could not speak with such a voice and convert others as he had been converted. I quote his words, "Oh, that I were an angel, that I might go forth and speak with the trump of God, with a voice to shake the earth, as with the voice of thunder," unquote, from Alma 29. The voice of the trumpet first shows up in the scriptures when the Israelites gathered at the foot of the mountain in Sinai. It was accompanied by smoke, fire, and earthquake in Exodus 19. There are other parallels with Alma's miraculous conversion. The Israelites were commanded to undergo a three-day purification rite in Exodus 19 also. Following the appearance of the angel, Alma collapsed and was paralyzed and on the brink of hell for 3 days and three nights. Elijah, like Moses and the Israelites, experienced wind, earthquake, and a fire at Mount Horeb, after which the Lord spoke to him in a still small voice. The great destructions which took place at the time of Christ's crucifixion were likewise followed by 3 days of darkness, then a small voice. During the destruction, that destruction, and I quote, "the face," probably the Hebrew word anat, though we don't have the gold plates to check it out, "the face of the whole earth became deformed because of the tempests and the thunderings and the lightnings and the quaking of the earth. And it came to pass that when the tempests and the lightnings and the storm and the tempests," that's what it says, redundant, I guess, "and the quakings of the earth did cease," maybe I typed it wrong, "there was darkness upon the face of the land." I know why. It's because there's an ellipsis in there. Like the Bible, the Book of Mormon views the earth as the mother of mankind. At death, the body returns to its mother earth, according to Mosiah 2 and Mormon 6. The Book of Mormon frequently notes that dead bodies and bones left on the surface of the earth pollute it. For this reason, slain Lamanites and Amalekite soldiers were cast into the waters of Sidon, and quote, and their behold, their bones are in the depths of the sea, and they are many, unquote. That's Alma 3. The casting of Lamanites slain in battle into the river Sidon by the Nephites, also in Alma chapter 44, appears to be related to the ritual purification of the land after the dry season of war, and was probably done for the same reason that Elijah had the bodies of the slain priests of Baal cast into the Kishon River. The practice parallels Anat's casting of her filth into the sea after a summer season of warfare. In Mormon 8 and 31, the, quote, great pollutions upon the face of the earth, unquote, are sins, which are listed rather than human corpses. These pollutions are associated with a time of fires, tempest, smoke, warfare, and earthquakes. In the same manner, prior to the cleansing by the flood, the earth was, quote, filled with violence and corrupt in Genesis chapter 6. Modern Revelation 2 reflects some of the ancient ideas, usually because it quotes from Bible and Book of Mormon passages. For example, Jesus came to the Kirtland Temple with the appearance of fire and spoke with a voice like rushing waters in Doctrine and Covenants 1:10. His presence, quote, is as the melting fire that burneth and as the fire which causeth the waters to boil, unquote, in Doctrine and Covenants 1:33. Latter-day Saint writings continue to personalize the earth. We address Dear Mother Earth in the fourth verse of hymn number 62, translated by William H. Draper from a poem written by St. Francis of Assisi, and based on Psalm 148. The psalm treats various heavenly bodies and other aspects of nature as if they were human. In a modern revelation, we read that, quote, the whole earth groans under the weight of its iniquity, unquote, DNC 123. In much the same manner that the earth groans in the Enoch story discussed earlier. Indeed, the earth is said to follow the same plan of salvation as men. And I quote from Doctrine and Covenants 88, beginning with verse 18. It must needs be sanctified from all unrighteousness, that it may be prepared for the celestial glory. For after it hath filled the measure of its creation, it shall be crowned with glory, even with the presence of God the Father. The earth abideth the law of a celestial kingdom, for it filleth the measure of its creation, and transgresseth not the law. Wherefore it shall be sanctified, yea, notwithstanding it shall die, it shall be quickened again, and shall abide the power by which it is quickened, and the righteous shall inherit it, unquote. As Joseph Smith and a group of elders were returning from their first trip to the land of Zion, Missouri, in August of 1831, the canoe in which Joseph and Sidney Rigdon were riding was overturned in the water. Of the events which ensued on August 12th, Joseph later wrote, quote, many of the dangers so common upon the western waters manifested themselves, and after we had encamped upon the bank of the river at McElwain's Bend, Brother William W. Phelps, in open vision by daylight, saw the destroyer in his most horrible power ride upon the face of the waters. Others heard the noise but saw not the vision. The next morning after prayer, I received the following, and here follows Doctrine and Covenants section 61, in which we read in part, behold, there are many dangers upon the waters, and more especially hereafter. For I, the Lord, have decreed in mine anger many destructions upon the waters, yea, and especially upon these waters. Nevertheless, all flesh is in mine hand, and he that is faithful among you shall not perish by the waters. Behold, I, the Lord, in the beginning blessed the waters, but in the last days, by the mouth of my servant John, in Revelation 8, I cursed the waters. Therefore, the days will come that no flesh shall be safe upon the waters. And it shall be said in days to come that none is able to go up to the land of Zion upon the waters, but he that is upright in heart. The decreed, and the destroyer rideth upon the face thereof, and I revoke not the decree. Nevertheless, unto whom is given power to command the waters, unto him it is given by the Spirit to know all his ways. Unquote. Satan's special control over the waters makes it easy to identify him with Yam of old, the rebellious water deity of the Canaanite pantheon. In the modern temple ceremony, Satan declares his reign over the rivers and the ends of the earth and speaks of using both armies and navies to accomplish his bloody purposes. But all this, we are promised, will come to an end when Jesus, like Baal and the ancient myths, will destroy the devil. And there I refer to Doctrine and Covenants 19. Let me quote next from 1 Nephi 19. The Lord God surely will visit all the house of Israel at that day, some with his voice, others with the thunderings and lightnings of his power, by tempest, by fire, and by smoke, and vapor of darkness, and by the opening of the earth, and by mountains which shall be carried up, and the rocks of the earth must rend. And because of the groanings of the earth, many of the kings of the isles of the sea shall be wrought upon by the Spirit of God to exclaim, "The God of nature suffers." This description of the destruction which accompanied Christ's death and which will also precede his second coming is very reminiscent of ancient descriptions of Baal bringing his thunderstorms and causing his wife, the earth goddess, to move. Christ will come in the clouds of heaven to reign upon the earth, in Doctrine and Covenants 76, perhaps in the same way that Adam was to rule over his wife Eve. And I should note here that the term Baal originally has sexual connotations. When it says that Adam will rule over Eve, it doesn't talk about political rule or anything like that. It refers to the fact that he's on top, literally, in Hebrew.
I'm shocked.
You shouldn't be. The missionary position is scriptural, you see. And after your testimony, I quote from Doctrine and Covenants 88, "And after your testimony cometh the testimony of earthquakes, and also cometh the testimony of the voice of thunderings, and the voice of lightnings, and the voice of tempests, and the voice of the waves of the heavens, of the sea, heaving themselves beyond their bounds." One further here before I conclude, which is very short. This is from Doctrine and Covenants 84. Nice poem that Joseph put into the section. "And Satan is bound, and time is no longer. The Lord hath gathered all things in one. The Lord hath brought down Zion from above. The Lord hath brought up Zion from beneath." Let's say the marriage of the lands and the marriage of heaven and earth. "The earth hath traveled and brought forth her strength, and the heavens have smiled upon her, and she is clothed with the glory of God, for he stands in the midst of his people." Returning to our original quote from the 7th chapter of Moses, we note again that not only is the rain seen as God's tears, but the earth, the mother of men, speaks with a voice, asking that the Creator cleanse her from the filthiness caused by the wickedness of men. God's response was to send the flood to cleanse the earth. When Enoch saw in vision the crucifixion of Christ, he, quote, "heard a loud voice, and the heavens were veiled, and all the creations of God mourned, and the earth groaned, and the rocks were rent." Looking into the distant future, the prophet, quote, "also saw the sea that it was troubled," unquote. At one point, Enoch is depicted as speaking unto the heavens, as if the sky were God himself. In response to his query about when the earth would be able to rest, the Lord responded in verse 61, "And the day shall come that the earth shall rest, but before that day the heavens shall be darkened, and a veil of darkness shall cover the earth, and the heavens shall shake, and also the earth, and great tribulation shall be among the children of men. But my people will I preserve, and righteousness will I send down out of heaven, and truth will I send forth out of the earth." All of these passages clearly reflect beliefs which held anciently about the earth, the sky, the sea, and other aspects of nature. But they do not reflect the Christian worldview of Joseph Smith's time. Because of this, they may be evidence for the antiquity of the Enoch story in the Book of Moses. Without our current knowledge of the ancient Baal epic, we might not fully understand the background of the biblical passages cited in this paper. Certainly, the Bible-reading Judeo-Christian world is generally ignorant of these connections, though scholars have long been aware of them. If we assume that Joseph Smith would have understood the King James rendition of these passages in the same sense as his contemporaries, it is difficult to accept that he would have been aware of their true implications. Unless one denies the very existence of Revelation, the simplest explanation for Joseph Smith's knowledge of his subject would appear to be a heavenly source. Clyde?
Let me just say to begin with, in our home, my wife and I prefer to rule over one another.
We didn't want details.
But, if you're going to... No, I'm just kidding. So, you don't want to hear this. You want to hear more about that, don't you?
Sorry I brought it up.
I will admit from the start that Mr. Svetnis and I do not agree on the issue of the antiquity of the original text of the Book of Mormon. I include here the Book of Abraham, and let's throw in the Book of Abraham or Book of Moses as well. His view, if I understand it correctly, is that the Book of Mormon in particular, which is what we kind of argued about last year, represents a translation of an ancient Near Eastern document with some wrinkles. While I do not deny that linguistic and literary parallels may exist, I am not convinced that a causal relationship can be established between the ever-growing corpus of ancient Near Eastern literature and LDS scripture. Mr. Svetnis' paper, entitled Mother Earth and Father Sky in LDS Scriptures and Ancient Near Eastern Belief, has failed to convince me otherwise. Let me explain. To summarize my complaints or criticisms, let me refer to just four. I thought that Mr. Svetnis' paper was problematic. I mean, it is a comparative analysis, and there's nothing wrong with comparative analysis. But I did think that it suffered from some anomalies. First, it falsely assumes that if A and B are alike, and A precedes B in time, then A is the source of B. Second, and related to the first, it is guilty of causal oversimplification, in my opinion, which is the logical fallacy of introducing factors insufficient to account for an event or overemphasizing the role of one or more of those factors. Third, it does not accurately represent the ancient mythology, which I was rather surprised by. And four, the paper is essentially an apologetic, which fails to live up to the reputation of its writer. I shall not speak at length concerning what I see to be as the methodological anomalies of his paper. Suffice it to say that Mr. Svetnis' argument depends almost entirely upon the conspicuous absence of contemporary source material in which such literary motifs as Father Sky and Mother Earth appear. However, by his own admission, there is the King James Version of the Bible, in particular the Psalms, which are cited with some frequency in his paper. Surely Joseph Smith might have simply been imitating the Psalms, you see what I'm saying, rather than this ancient Near Eastern mythology. Whether he knew it or not, I see as a moot point. Anyway, consider, too, 19th century hymnals, which either borrowed from the Psalms wholesale or imitated psalmic language and phraseology. And what about the literature of the Romantic movement, in which the God of nature is a prominent theme? Then there is the revival of Neoplatonism during this period, in which material creation was thought to be a rational and spiritual entity. In my paper yesterday, I quoted from Agrippa, who talks about the earth as having a soul, as being a rational being, as really conforming to all of the things that Mr. Svetnis has said or claimed had to come from this ancient Near Eastern worldview. Also, the 18th and 19th century intellectual movement known as deism, or natural religion. Here again, we have another contemporary source, concurrent with Joseph, in which these ideas are very much a part of what's going on. Clearly, there is a plethora of source material that might be consulted before calling upon revelation as, quote, the simplest explanation for Joseph Smith's knowledge of this subject. So that's as much as I'll say about on and on, obviously. I won't. Instead, I'll let John respond to some of that. The balance of my criticisms shall address the more disturbing issue of what I found to be various factual and or interpretative anomalies in the paper. This may be a bit heavy going. I'll try to simplify it as much as possible. This is the thing about biblical studies. I spent 5 years in biblical studies. And the wonderful thing is that no one knows what the hell you're talking about, and so often you can say anything, and who can criticize you? I mean, who can say the stem with is not what you said it is? It's come, I mean, people have better things to do with their time than that, and so I mean, we all can have problems, and I don't mean to point a finger just at John. I mean, goodness knows I've done the same thing. But let me just sort of go through some of the questions that I had when I read the paper. Under the heading Canaanite mythology, Mr. Svatnes informs us that Yam slew Baal, that Yam, the sea, was in turn slain by Anat, and that Baal's release from the underworld was the cause of a bargain between Baal and Mot.
Between Anat and Mot.
You said that Baal and Mot struck a bargain. Did you not?
If I said it, it was incorrect. It's Anat.
Yes. Yes, indeed, it is. I shall quote from Craigie's brief but lucid account of the Baal myth taken from his book entitled Ugarit and the Old Testament. So let's just take a minute and get the story from somebody else. See what they've said about it. And I quote, "The opening scene indicates that El is the supreme god. The rising power in this divine world is the god Yam. Tension develops between Baal and Yam, leading eventually to a battle between them. They begin to fight, and at first, it seems that Yam will be victorious. But Baal, says Craigie, is ultimately victorious." Now, remember that Mr. Svatnes had told us that Yam, not Baal, was victorious. Craigie goes on to explain, "In the story of Baal and Mot, which is the third narrative, and I should say here that when we're talking about the Baal myth, we're talking about a corpus of literature that was only discovered in the 30s, 1930s, and it is not clear whether it is a consistent whole, you see, or pieces of different narratives. And so there is other stuff that's spoken about. There are other characters, King Carrot and people like this. But where the Baal myth is concerned, there are really three narratives. And we don't know, or at least the people who are spending all of their time on this, aren't really sure that these three narratives are to be read in sequence. They don't know if three are interrelated in different ways. You see, we don't know. And it becomes very problematic when we begin to try and summarize what the Baal myth is, because it may be a composite of many myths. Anyway, in the story of Baal and Mot, which is the third narrative of the three, if we just sort of, we say it's the third, that everyone agrees it's the third, Mot rises as a new threat to the power and authority of Baal. And the tension results eventually in two battles between them. In the first confrontation, Baal is defeated and is confined within the netherworld by Mot. But eventually Baal is rescued by the combined efforts of two goddesses, Anat and Shapish. The violent goddess, Anat, achieves her deliverance by engaging Mot in conflict and slaying him. Baal is returned to his earthly throne and authority as a consequence." Okay, so there's what Craigie says the Baal myth is about. And there are some startling differences between what Craigie says about it and what John has said about it. And I would ask him to kind of explain to me why that was. I found it very curious. I was also perplexed by Mr. Svetna's translation of Ugaritic and Hebrew texts. One problem with his paper was that it was very difficult to know who the sources for some of his ideas. I mean, I really wanted to blame someone else. I wanted to blame Casuto or somebody else. And while he did refer to Casuto's book, that, as far as I could tell, was the only secondary source reference that he referred to in the entire paper. And so when he said that these different names meant different things, you see, I had a hard time finding other people who were in agreement with him. So here are some examples. Let's take his translation of the proper name Anat as surface of the earth, which I think we... Let me explain it this way.
This is what it looks like on the page.
Now, when he says it means surface of the earth, what we see on the page is something that seems to suggest to me that one might find Anat as meaning surface, but of the earth is something I don't know where it's come from. Then there is the epithet ascribed to Anat, which he translated as mother of man. I went to the lexicons and I looked to see what they had to say. Now, according to the Hebrew lexicon, let me backtrack for a moment. Driver who is also part and parcel of the Hebrew lexicon and has done much work on the Baal myth. According to Driver, Ayin, Nun, Tau, the Hebrew consonants which make up the, you know, the proper name Anat, is derived from the root ani, which he says might mean furrow. Now, maybe this is what John is referring to. I don't know. There was no documentation. Albright, of course, translated the proper name Anat as, quote, sign of indication, which he believed to be a reference to the will of Baal, not the wife of Baal. As for the epithet, could this be Kasudo's Hebrew translation? Unfortunately, the library at UFC only had the Hebrew translation of Kasudo's book, which made my life very, very uncomfortable and miserable as I tried to work through it. But one thing that I mean, as I say, I just have no way of knowing, but it seemed to me that Kasudo did talk about Anat and did refer to this epithet. But if you look closely at the Hebrew, what we have is a Hebrew translation of the Ugaritic. And while the Hebrew says something like mother of nations, mother of men, I guess that's the same thing, leaves out women, though, doesn't it? We should be told this. In any event, I had great difficulty finding support for this translation. Another of Mr. Svetna's translations that gave me trouble was his analysis of Hosea chapter 2, in which he translated Baali as my husband and Ishi as my man. Now, although Baal is, you know, sometimes translated as Lord, I mean, it certainly means that, if it is translated at all, and I tend to find it used as a proper name most of the time, it can also mean husband, as in the Arabic Baalun, you see. So he didn't tell us that. Nevertheless, Ish, you know, this is...
Did I?
Can I finish? Thanks. Nevertheless, Ish, which is usually translated as man, I mean, it's one of the first things you learn in Hebrew, that's what I was taught anyway, can also mean husband. Again, this is coming out of Brown, Driver, and Briggs. However, Brown, Driver, and Briggs, in their Hebrew and English lexicon of the Old Testament, suggest that the Ishi in Hosea 2:16, this is the same, I think the same passage that John referred to, should be translated as my husband, rather than my man. Thus, Mr. Svetna's translation, in this case, is the reverse of what others have suggested. If we can trust Brown, Driver, and Briggs on this, they could certainly be wrong. But, again, I would have liked to have seen some references to these problems. Nevertheless, the most eccentric of Mr. Svetna's claims was his reference to Baal as Father Sky and Anat as Mother Earth, since the Rosh Hashanah texts clearly identify El, the senior god of the Canaanite pantheon, as the creator. El is referred to as B'nai Banut, which means something like the creator of created things. Another of his titles is Avadam, the father of men. Although in this case I should emphasize that here the relationship is probably social rather than physical. Clearly there is no sense in which Anat is Mother Earth, nor is she the mother of humankind. Moreover, Baal is not exclusively Father Sky, as Mr. Svetna said, but as Gray explains, and I quote, a nature god manifest in the winter storms, so we have Baal in the storms, and secondarily in the vegetation thereby promoted. So you see, Baal seems to be both in the sky and on the earth at the same time. My only point here is that it's not quite as straightforward as John has led us to believe. As for Mr. Fenton's discussion of Yahweh and Baal, this I found to be less problematic. There are contradictory views, which he did not refer to, perhaps in the more amplified version he does. I don't know. I haven't seen that. I would, however, just suggest that Eisfeld, in my opinion, makes a rather good case for the natural assimilation of the attributes of El by Yahweh. So you see, El, the supreme god of the Canaanite pantheon, may have been the figure that the Hebrew writers were thinking of rather than Baal. Because, you see, there is good reason to think that people didn't have, these Hebrew writers may not have thought very fondly of Baal. But again, there's much debate about this. There are some other translational things. I was also perplexed by Mr. Svetna's interpretation of Psalm 24:1. Rather than a statement referring to the earth as symbolically the wife of Jehovah, It is usually, or in all of the source material that I read, tends to be understood as, quote, an affirmation of the Lord's dominion over the created world and its inhabitants. Furthermore, Craigie argues that although the language of Psalm 24 borrows from Canaanite mythology, quote, it is a transformation of Canaanite cosmogony. As far as a comparison of the victory march in Anat and Psalm 24, 7 through 10, which Mr. Svetnes claims to be the consensus of scholarship, I have failed to uncover any evidence of this. Instead, it is the kingship of Baal following his conquest of Yam, which is central to both Ugarit mythology and Psalm 24. At least this is the view of those scholars I consulted. Under the heading Victorious Jehovah, Mr. Svetnes argues that Baal is depicted as the loser in his battle against the sea god Yam. I'm quoting from him. While it is Anat who defeats Yam. But the Bible, he notes, quote, makes Jehovah victorious and gives him some of Anat's attributes. Again, I must emphasize the fact that nowhere in the Ugaritic text is Baal depicted as the loser against Yam. I refer you to the texts themselves where Baal's victory over Yam is described. Here I'm reading from an English translation, of course. This is a take, I think, from Driver's. Yes. The mace whirled in Baal's hand like an eagle. Grasped in his fingers, it crushed the shoulder of Prince Yam, the chest of Judge Nachar. And the mace whirled in Baal's hand like an eagle. Grasped in his fingers, it crushed the pate of Prince Yam, the forehead of Judge Nachar. Judge Nachar and Yam are essentially the same person, really, two titles of the same being. Yam collapsed and fell down to the earth. His face quivered and his features crumpled up. Verily, Yam is dead, and Baal shall be king. Lo, the victor Baal. Mr. Svetnes then goes on to talk about, and I quote, peoples of the ancient Near East who thought of the earth as the mother of mankind. So he's left, I assume, that the Ugaritic text to talk more generally. Here again, though, I had some problems. This is questionable. The first problem is that the Baal myth is not a creation myth. So here we have one really serious problem with referring to the Baal myth as talking of Mother Earth and the creation of humankind. We're not really dealing with a creation myth. At least, again, that's the consensus of opinion. Furthermore, quote, peoples of the ancient Near East held more than one view concerning the origin, nature, and destiny of humanity. True, the Sumerians believed that humans grew from the earth like grass and herbs, which we can read in the myth of the creation of the Ho. But in the Akkadian myth of Atrahasis, humanity is said to be the byproduct of clay and the blood of a rebel god. In the famous Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation story, which is thought to be the basis for the biblical creation story, which is then a kind of polemic against the Babylonians, Enki fashions humanity out of the blood of the slain rebel leader Kingu. Suffice it to say that ancient Near Eastern beliefs concerning the origin of humanity were rather more diverse than Mr. Svetnes would lead us to believe. I've talked much too long. Let me skip some things. I was also baffled by his reference to the Doctrine and Covenants as reflective of the ancient Near East. Now, he did say that one of the reasons that we might find ancient Near Eastern mythology in the Doctrine and Covenants is because it might borrow from the Book of Mormon and the Bible. And to be fair to John, I should acknowledge that. I just don't understand why he talks about it. I would have preferred that he just left that out and talked about texts that at least purport to be of ancient origin, you know what I'm saying? When he notes that, quote, modern Revelation 2 reflects some of the ancient ideas, usually because it quotes from the Bible and the Book of Mormon passages, does it not occur to him that the same might be said of the latter in relation to the former? So if we're going to find ancient Near Eastern mythology in the Book of Mormon, let's say, or the Book of Moses, And we're finding lots of similar things in the Bible, could Joseph not have just had the Bible in mind? It's a question I think should be considered. In conclusion, I refer to you something that the late Peter Craigie, an Ugaritic specialist, said concerning the pitfalls of comparative Ugaritic Hebrew studies. Here I would add Ugaritic Hebrew Mormon studies. This is what Craigie said. The growth of comparative Ugaritic Hebrew studies has been marked by both glorious triumphs and fearful errors. The difficulty one faces in reading the plethora of literature on the subject lies in distinguishing the triumphs from the tragedies. I think, you know, to try and say something positive about what John has done, which I had difficulty. I tried. And one problem was that, for me anyway, now I could be completely wrong, but I had so much difficulty, you know, swallowing his version of the Ugaritic myth to begin with, that everything else that he said just seemed to fall like a stack of cards, you know, a house of cards. Interestingly, though, I think that the idea is a good one. As I said, there's nothing wrong with comparative analysis, but why don't we be more careful about it? And one thing that I would recommend that John consider is the fact that El and Yah, who are two characters in the Canaanite literature, which seem to correspond or may correspond to the biblical Elohim and Yahweh or Jehovah, are proper names. Now, you know, Mormons are somewhat peculiar in their belief that Elohim is a proper name. This is not the view of the great majority. And yet here we have an instance where there seems to be a similar kind of thing going on. Why don't we do something like that and look at... I think this would make an excellent paper. Strangely enough, though, the idea of Father Sky and Mother Earth does not make for a very good paper. Thank you.
Just maybe a couple seconds. I think the only thing that concerns me are the comments regarding the Ugaritic mythology. I did not go to most of the commentaries. There are a few that I've looked at. Actually, I used Kasuda only as a reference. I studied Ugaritic at the Hebrew University under Jonas Greenfield, who was formerly at Berkeley. And my background in the Ugaritic mythology comes from Greenfield and also Ginsberg, who did a lot of work in the area. And in fact, there are texts that do say that Yam slew Baal. This is simply not true, Clyde. And Anat even goes to her father El and in tears, talking about how Yam has slain Baal and he's not around anymore. The earth is going to die because there are going to be no more rains. And El comes down from his throne, orders a pile of ashes put in his throne room. He sits down in it. He strips himself. He takes a sharp stone, cuts incisions in the roll of his arm and between his eyes and on his temples. Yes, it's there for sure. The reason for the Anat surface of the earth is because people are usually used to seeing one word translated as one word. The term Anat is, by most scholars that I know at least...
Who says it means that?
Well, Ginsberg says it means that. Greenfield says it means that.
Well,
Rabin says it means that. Well, because I'm a Semitic scholar, I expected people would accept what I said. That's my background. I don't have to quote from BDB because this is what I do. And it does, in fact, mean the surface of the earth and refers to that. And there are several biblical passages I could have brought up. And that is, in fact, called the Mother of Men. I'll transliterate it for you from the Ugaritic if you want.